cracks a long knife with a black blade.
"Look at you," Kolob says. "A little savage who learned to sing. Knowing what fork to use makes you no less of a feral child. Here you are, come to show me how much you've grown. And yet I see you've grown not a whit. You speak of purpose. What is our purpose today, little gully? Why bring me here? No, you don't need to answer that. I see the purpose is now in your hand. Though after all this time, why?"
Rax steps into the room. The knife is light, but feels heavy. Its blade is knocked with teeth. Rax closes in on the bound man, speaking as he does. "You told me that children were best when they were seen and not heard. You said that children were meant to be quiet and to serve, to kneel and to suffer, and to not ask for a life of any merit, for service is reward enough."
"I did say those things. I believe them."
Rax leans in. His voice lowers to a whisper. "You believe lies. It is not our job to suffer. It is not our lot to simply serve. My destiny was greater than that. If I had listened to you, I'd still be here on this rock, kneeling for you, praying for you, listening to your bone chimes ring, doing the chores you demanded I do. But I have only one chore here today." He thrusts the blade into the man's middle. He works it deeper. His hand grows warm and wet.
"Gully!"
"Gallius Rax, you mean. No more children will be swept aside by your hand. No more will be made to serve the anchorites." The man smiles, a grim red smile.
"I told you all of life was suffering. And for you, the suffering is just beginning. You are hunted, Gally. All your plans will unravel."
He slumps backward, the blade freed with a faint sucking sound as he falls away, dead. It is done. Rax feels a great weight lifted from him. A hand on his shoulder eases him back. Tashu says quietly in his ear,
"A necessary sacrifice. The dark side is stronger. Our mission here is blessed now."
"Yes, it is. The true mission, at least." He nods and goes along with what Tashu says. Though the man has knowledge greater than most, even still, he is a madman. An ardent believer in the black-edged side of the Force. And Rax cares nothing for such mysticism. But if it appeases Tashu, then the illusion that he, too, is a believer may commence. He'll need Tashu, after all. Now Tashu says,
"I do not wish to rush the sacrifice. I want to gift you the time to revel. But time is narrow, and you have a visitor."
"A visitor?"
"Yes. Come."
They go deeper into the underground, around a bundling of power cables, past a coupling of ion panels, into a pitch-black hallway. The lights come on. There at the end is a figure in a red cloak. Rax knows who, or what, it is. He steps forward, suddenly concerned. What is there to report? He knows it must be something, and it must be important. A visit from a sentinel like this does not come lightly. The figure in the cloak turns. The face of Emperor Sheev Palpatine looks back upon him. That face flickers across the glass bulge of the droid's mask. It is artifice, but even as a proxy, it is close enough to the real thing to haunt him. Other sentinels were merely messengers. They appeared, gave commands, and were gone. But these, the ones reserved for Rax and their master plan, are smarter. They're sentient. Though none truly match Palpatine's strategic brilliance and his dark, terrible mind, they approximated enough. The voice, too, is close enough to curdle his blood. The droid sentinel speaks in Palpatine's voice.
The farthest perimeter has been breached.
Show me.
From the sleeve of the red cloak, the droid's black metal hand emerges. In the center of its skeletal palm is a projector. And now that circle beams a holographic image into the air, gently turning. The three-dimensional image shows a caravan traveling across the valley floor. Wheel cars and beast mounts and wanderers. At the end of it all is a raised platform held aloft on hover rails, eased along by men holding heavy gauge chains. And on that platform is a hut. Nima. The droid's thumb flicks reflexively, like a spasm, but one that has a function. With every twitch, the image changes. It shows the caravan from different angles, sometimes at a distance, sometimes close. The valley is littered with cams, long hidden under the sand and dust or embedded in the rock. All part of a network that's been in place for nearly 3 decades now. The image suddenly zooms in on the platform, and Rax gasps. The image shows a woman. Her black hair is pulled back under a winding of ratty ribbon. Her eyes are concealed behind thick goggles. Her skin is dark. He knows her. He would know Grand Admiral Ray Sloane anywhere.
She lives, he says. And, Tashu says, she closes in on the observatory.
How soon?
It is the sentinel who answers.
Given the rate of movement, 3 days.
3 days. Good. That is plenty of time to end their journey. To the droid, Rax says, arm the defenses.
Sloane, I admire your tenacity, but I have to finish this.
Chapter 16. Slow, slow, like a belly slit worm struggling through a rut slow. Ray Sloane walks alongside a massive platform. A stage, really. A dais on rusted hover rails, chugging and buzzing. It's drawn forward by hut slaves, pulling on fat chains draped over their bony shoulders. On the stage sits Nima the Hutt, coiled in a nest of ratty pillows under a massive leather tent. The Hutt sleeps, snorting and snoring, bubbles of mucus burping up through her nose slits. The occasional wind comes and tousles the filthy red ribbons tied around her many nodules and protuberances. This is the rear of the caravan. But the stage and its riders are far from the sum of it. Ahead walk dozens of hut slaves. Others ride wheel bikes or old speeders whose grav lifts have broken and are now mounted atop rolling platforms. Their engines converted from clean turbines to growling, smoke-belching locomotives. Some ride leathery reptilian beasts, whose bodies are fitted with metal plates and crude bionetic enhancements, like telescoping eyes or pneumatic jaws. All of it churns and trundles along through a sun-scoured, wind-whipped valley. And on each side of them stand spires of red stone and anvil-shaped plateaus, like the guardians of a forbidden place. Those plateaus cast long shadows across this deep valley.
This is arduous, Sloane growls.
Brenton Wexley looks up at her. He's weary. Lines of frustration have been permanently etched into his forehead. His cheeks are reddened by the blowing sands. Her own cheeks must be stung the same way. Her goggles are already caked with dust, too. And as she does every couple of minutes, she has to wipe them free with the backs of her hands. The two of them hang back beyond the dragging dais. Though Nima sleeps, they dare not say anything against her within easy earshot.
"Progress is progress," he says.
Ever the optimist. Surely by now it's just a show.
Our fates are married to the huts.
It's been nearly a week.
I know.
We need to seize the moment. I've been thinking,
she says.
A look of worry crosses his face. Do I want to know?
You do, and you will. And you'll not dismiss me. I have a plan.
What is it?
The hut sleeps during the day, which means that is the time to strike. Soon, even. Today.
Are you batty? Killing a hut is no easy thing.
We're not attacking her.
Who? Her people? She sneers.
Don't call them people. They're barely that anymore. They've been enslaved for so long, they've been programmed into something else.
But even as she says it, she hears the way it must sound to him. Brenton flinches, as if the words were almost physical, the back of a hand swinging for him.
I don't mean it like that, Wexley. They're not like you.
It's fine, he says, newly curt. Let's not debate what makes us human.
You want to attack the slaves, then?
We don't have weapons.
They do. And I am a weapon. I'm trained. I can fight.
We can't fight them all.
I only need one or two. They have those wheel bikes. We take out the riders and steal the bikes. Those engines must have some power. We grab one and we go. Fast as we can.
They'll come after us.
I know. But what choice do we have?
We keep going. Same as we've been. Like you said, it's been nearly a week. Why change course now?
She steps in front of him and blocks his path.
Because I just thought of the plan.
It's a lie, and he calls her on it, his voice low as he does.
The plan isn't even a plan. It's so obvious we could have done it from the beginning.
No, what's changed is you're desperate, hungry to have vindication, and you hate that it's delayed. You don't feel the same way? You want your vengeance, too.
His face is suddenly stark with...
What is that?
Is it sadness?
Sloane, it's not vengeance I want. Don't lie. If it's not vengeance, then what? What drives you to be out here in this hell-blasted deadland?
She leans in close and lifts her goggles so she can stare at him with her cold, dark eyes.
Rage flares up in her at the thought he does not share her desire for comeuppance. You mean to tell me you don't want to put a blaster to Gallius Rax's forehead?
I do. Stars help me, I do. But that's not why I'm here. I want to make up for what I did.
It's so absurd an idea. Sloane can't help but bark an incredulous laugh.
Make up for what? Chandrilla? Someone stuck a chip in your head, Brenton. You were dancing on the end of Rax's puppet strings. We all were. You don't have to own that. You can just cut his strings because it feels good to cut his damn strings.
I need to stop Rax because it's how I show my wife and my son that I'm not the man on that stage. It's how I fix what I did.
Sloane grabs a fistful of his shirt.
You're a fool. It's vengeance that carries us. Forget everyone else.
He pauses. The sadness on his face deepens. The look he gives her is one of pity.
You don't have anybody, do you? That's why you don't understand. There's nobody out there who you love, or who loves you back.
Those words are like a blaster shot to her middle. clean through, leaving a hole as big as a fist. He keeps going.
You have to have something or someone to fight for. Not just this. Not just revenge.
I have what I have.
You have the Empire. You can save it.
This is rich. The Rebel telling me how to save my Empire. My Empire? It's dead. It died the moment it touched this planet. The only thing I have, and the only thing I need, is the look on Rax's face as I take it all away.
She looks over her shoulder at the caravan. Already they're lagging as being noticed by the bone-faced acolytes.
I'm retaking control of this situation. You can come with me, or you can die a hut slave.
And with that, she turns and marches back to the caravan. Sloane is singularly focused. Ahead, the slaves on wheelbikes do loops in and around the caravan, the caesium fuel burning black out their tailpipes. She storms up alongside the dais, calculating her path of attack. One hut slave walks in front of her. He's one of the few with a blaster, a rifle cradled in some creature's ribcage, the barrel framed by a pair of broken tusks. One punch, and she'll have that blaster. That will draw attention. She'll need to run and gun. But that'll time out right. The one on the fat-bellied wheel bike doing loops will be within range. Take him out, grab the bike. It'll be like that time on Yan Corelda, when she was just a recruit in the Empire and barely got away from a gang of rebel thugs after refueling her speeder bike. One of their blaster bolts literally cooked a tuft of her hair. She could smell it burning for hours after. She charges forward, past the dais, past a duo of hut slaves who babble at her as she pushes onward. Sloane has no idea where Brenton is, if he's hot on her heels or burying his head in the sand. She doesn't care. She can't care. Her goal is the blaster rifle, then the wheel bike, then Rax. The hut slave doesn't even know to suspect her. By the time she's upon him and he's turning his head toward her, she drives a fist into the back of his skull. His teeth snap together, and he doesn't even make a sound. All he does is pitch forward, face planting into the sand. And as he does, she catches his blaster and wrenches it out of his grip. Now she has a weapon. Nima didn't let her or Brenton have blasters. On this journey, they've been nothing but spectators, buckled into a ride they didn't ask to take. That changes now. But the wheel bike that had been coming her way suddenly kicks up a spray of sand and goes back the other way, its engine growling.
No! Get back here, you hot-sucking freak!
She starts to run, but now cries of alarm rise up around her. Nima's slaves howling and calling for their mistress. And the hut does not disappoint. Sloane hears the mechanical gargle of the slug's translator box as it transmits her rage to the world.
Stop her!
It all happens so fast. One slave comes up at her, and she cracks the butt end of the blaster rifle into his chin. He swallows teeth and goes down, flailing, and two more come charging up in his place. Sloane raises the rifle, aims. Two spears of laser light end them as she fires the blaster. Each slave goes down with a smoking hole in the center of his chest. Something clubs her in the side of the head. Her ears ring as she tumbles to the sand, rolling over and reflexively holding up the blaster across her face just as a slave brings his sharpened machete down. The blade sticks into the side of the rifle. The slave struggles to extract it. Someone tackles the slave from behind, knocking him back. Brenton. Wexley kicks at the freak with a boot, then grabs the machete with one hand and helps Sloane up with the other. As he hauls her to standing, Sloane hears a sound. The hissing of sand. The chanting of the slaves. And it's then she knows that something is coming. Nima. If Sloane has maintained one common belief about huts, it's that they are indolent, lethargic creatures. They are called slugs for a reason. But Nima defies this handily. This creature is not some torpid glob. Sloane looks back over Brenton's shoulder, and fear fills her empty spaces the way fire gobbles air. The hut slams down off her dais, hitting the sand with a cough of dust. Nima slithers toward them, fast as a viper. Hut slaves cling to her like riders, their mouths open, their teeth bared. They have blasters. They start firing. Sloane grabs Brenton's arm, and they break into a hard run. Blaster bolts kick up sand around their feet. Behind them, the hissing sound of Nima's body sliding across the sand grows louder and closer. She has no idea how near the hut is to them, but it's close enough that Sloane starts to smell the foul stink of the monster. She thinks to turn behind her and fire into the serpent's face, but the slaves will just swarm her. No, the plan is the plan, and she needs to stick with it. Get to the wheeled bikes! She takes aim as she runs, tracking one of the riders with the sights of her rifle. But something distracts her. In the distance, far away in the valley, she spies a flash of light. Something glinting off the high day sun. The hut roars behind her. A shadow falls upon her as Nima rises up, lifting her whole corpulent body with the sheer strength and will of her tail. The air fills with white light. A shrieking pillar of green fire fills the space. And before Sloane even knows what's happening, there's a thunderclap, and she's thrown to the ground. A column of smoke drifts from somewhere, and her eyes follow it to the source. Nima's hover dais is collapsed into the sand, sheared in half. The hut mistress herself is within spitting distance. The slug is dazed, tilting toward her side. Nima shakes her head as her reptilian eyes refocus. Sand streams from her crumpled, rotten skull. The hut bellows something in proto-Huttese, but the translation is lost to another bolt piercing the air, and one of the wheel cars suddenly flips up, turning once, twice, before slamming back down on top of one of the beasts. The creature screams as its back snaps. Turbo lasers. That's what's firing on them. Sloane knows that sound, that beam. She's never been on the ground when they've been firing, and she's never been the one in their sights. But she knows what they can do. And if they don't move, they're all dead. Change of plans. The wheel bike won't save her. But those plateaus, they might. She reaches down to find her one ally in all this. Sloane looks over and sees that half of Brenton Wexley is missing. Oh no. But then he sits up, sand and dust seeming to melt off him. Somehow a wave of it buried part of him. He coughs and hacks, but there's no time for him to clear his lungs. So Sloane gets behind him and helps him stand. She points. The plateaus! Run! They run. Just as another turbo laser blast turns one of the wheel bikes to ash.
Interlude. Christophsis. On the first day, five pilgrims depart from their starship and set out across one of the countless deep cave systems of Christophsis. They set out with great purpose, bringing with them a sacred gift that was stolen from this place not that long ago. Kyber crystals. Gems that grow at only a few precious spots here on this world. Though much of this world is crystalline, the Kyber crystals are considerably more rare. The Kyber crystals were taken from this world by the Empire and used to construct the world-killing laser of the Death Star. Though they were also used by the once peacekeepers of this galaxy, the Jedi, in constructing their lightsabers.
Bryn Iziska said that these must be returned from whence they came, Christophsis, to their, in his words, home. One of the pilgrims is a droid, an MABO cargo lifter droid they call Mabo, and he is the one who carries the crate that holds what was stolen. On the third day, as they march up a steep, rocky embankment, studded with crystal spires and slippery scree, Adar, the human, confides in his friend Juman, the Ayakeru.
I don't know why we are doing this.
Juman shrugs it off and growls.
Because this is what must be done.
His whiskers twitch when he says it, as if this explains it all. And yet Adar, who is young, untested, and uncertain, persists.
I just mean, what's the point?
Tonight, around the fire, we will watch the Holovids again to help you understand.
And they do. When night falls, they start a fire underneath one of the vents leading out to the open sky, where Adar looks up and sees a spray of stars that gleam and glitter like the walls of these caves. Juman has Madramagath, the Elomin, set out the projector disc. From it emits the crackling, staticky hollow form of Bryn Iziska, the pastor and philanthropist who governs their faith and their community, the Church of the Force. The image of Iziska goes on about the heritage of the Force, about how all things are connected, and about how the Jedi do not control the Force, but rather are merely conduits for it.
Antennae, attuned to that cosmic frequency,
the man says. And even in the hollow form, it's easy to see the wonder dancing in his eyes like torchlight. But Adar isn't feeling it. Adar isn't feeling any of it. When the vid is done, Juman must sense his apprehension and barks,
We do it because we do it. Because these must return home.
Juman rolls over in his pack and goes to sleep. And that's the end of that. On the fourth day, they enter the crystal forest. Here, the trees are weak and wispy, their bulk more like threads than trunks, their branches like filaments. And yet they stand tall, because they are encased in blue crystal. Some even grow up from the ground and marry with the ceiling. When the cave wind moves through them, it keens and moans, a shrill cacophony coupled with dread, groaning lamentations. As the fourth day ends and the fifth day begins, Madramagath consults with Ugorda the Duros. His cheeks lose their rosy bloom, and his horns twitch as he says,
We are being hunted.
Ugorda confirms it, and she says,
Stay vigilant.
Given how rarely she speaks, the warning carries extra meaning, and fear scurries through every micrometer of Adar.
We shouldn't have come, he thinks.
On the sixth day, Madramagath is found dead. He goes off into the crystal trees to relieve himself, and he never returns. They discover his body, cut to pieces as if by saw blade. Juman snarls.
Now we know what hunts us.
What?
Adar asks.
Kayadak.
They do not stop to camp that night. They hurry on. On the morning of the seventh day, they hear the Kayadak. The tack, tack, tack of their many limbs. The click, click, click of their calissary. By midday, they begin to see their sign. Scratches in the crystalline trees. Gleaming silicate scat smeared across bulging rock. By evening, they see them. Just flashes and shadows at the margins, far away and down branching tunnels, but closer than anyone cares to discover. His voice trembling and his breath weak as they hurry on, Adar says,
I hate those things. Why won't they leave us alone? We should kill them.
Juman says,
They are creatures of the Force, too.
So?
So we do not attack.
But we know they'll attack us.
It is their way.
Maybe their way is the dark side.
Maybe Bryn has it right,
Juman says.
Maybe there is no dark side.
It can't be that simple. I believe in evil. So does Bryn. Besides...
Adar lifts his shirt and shows what he brought. A small blaster pistol.
I have this. We can use it.
You shouldn't have brought that. A lethal weapon? Here? On this sacred place? You know, Ra.
Ugorda shushes them both, and they continue on. On the eighth day, Ugorda is dead. Or so they believe. The Kayadak come out of nowhere. Three of them. Their saw blade limbs cutting her down as the massive bugs pounce upon her, pincers holding her fast. Juman has his telescoping staff out quick as anything, and he bares his teeth as it spins in his hand like a whirring rotor. He and Mabo leap into the fray. The droid lifts one of the Kayadak high, flinging it into the trees. Branches snap, and crystal rains to the ground like a hail of singing, tinkling glass. Juman's staff connects with one of the bug's many eye heads, closing it permanently as it erupts in a gush of fluid. The thing shrieks and skitters away. The last one is Adar's. He rushes up to it, fear governing his limbs. He closes his eyes and draws the blaster pistol, firing it wantonly in the air. Not to kill, just to scare it off. He knows that when he opens his eyes, the monster will be upon him, cutting open his middle. But he hears its many limbs go tack, tack, tack in the other direction. Adar opens his eyes, and it's gone. Together they stare at Ugorda's dead body. Until she sits up suddenly, slick with her own blood. Adar wonders if she came back from the dead somehow, or if she was just not injured as badly as he thought. Ugorda wheezes.
Let us keep moving. Those three will just be the first. They claim this forest as territory. When we are free of the trees, we are free of the Kayadak.
They do as Ugorda says, helping her along. On the ninth day, they are out of the forest. Here the rocky ground gives way to crystal beneath, slippery and smooth. A thousand facets on which to lose one's footing. That night, they sit around the fire again. Mabo tends to Ugorda's wounds with a surprising tenderness, delicate despite the droid's massive, box-lifting limbs. Around the fire, Adar says to Juman,
I want to ask you something.
Ask?
Juman purrs.
When did you become a believer?
Juman shrugs like it's no big thing.
I had an experience. A vision called to me 3 years ago. It showed me a path through a wilderness not far from my home. I followed it, and there I found Bryn, injured after having fallen into a crevasse. I helped him, and he told me it was destiny that we met. That what guided me was the Force.
You're lying. The Force is only for the Jedi.
No,
Juman says, not angry so much as he is incredulous.
They wield it, but the Force is in all living things. It is what gives us our intuition, our drive. It's what connects us to one another. We are all one with the Force.
The Force, the Force, the Force, everything the Force.
Adar is frustrated and afraid. He has no faith in this or in Aziska. Just because his mother helped found the church doesn't mean he has to be a believer too, does it?
This is a fool's mission, a death parade.
One of the so-called pilgrims is already dead. Another is almost perished.
He whispers, how many more of us have to die to carry this burden? We didn't steal these things. The Empire did. They should be the ones performing penance.
We all carry the burden. We all pay the penance. Because...
Yes, yes, I know. Because we are all children of the Force.
You should watch more of Isiska's hollow form.
I don't want to.
But after the others are asleep, that's exactly what Adar does. He watches a vid of Bryn reading from the Journal of the Wills.
The truth in our soul is that nothing is true. The question of life is what then do we do? The burden is ours. To penance we hew. The Force binds us all from a certain point of view.
Adar fails to understand what it means. But he admits he enjoys listening to Bryn. He falls asleep wondering who the man really is. No one seems to know much about him. He and many of the patrons and matrons of the church are mysterious. On the 10th day, they walk underneath an outcropping of crystal-encrusted rock, and a jagged stalactite of midnight glass breaks off. It spears Ugorda through the top of her head, and with that, she is truly gone. Then they are three. On the 12th day, they are hungry. They have food, of course, but all that's left are protein packets and neutro pills, and though such grim victuals keep them going, it's hardly satisfying. As night falls on that day, Mabo missteps across weak ground, and the crystalline mantle cracks hard beneath him. There is a moment when everyone realizes what is happening. The droid clings to the shelf, his telescoping eyes glowing white with panic. Adar leaps for the crate and catches the handle. Mabel lets go, because surely the droid understands that Adar cannot hold both the machine and the crate. And also, as Juman will soon point out,
Mabel had faith. He was a believer, a pilgrim like us, and a friend.
But Adar must ask himself, is he really a pilgrim? Or did the droid have more faith than he? Adar saves the crate, even as the droid falls through the open gap.
Bryn would be proud,
Juman says, grinning a feral vulpine grin.
You made a leap of faith, and the Force rewarded you. The Force rewarded us all,
he smirks.
I have something to confess.
So, confess.
The vision I had, I still believe in it, but...
His voice trails off.
But what?
I was drunk at the time.
Let's just get this done, Adar says, rolling his eyes.
We're almost there.
He and his friend both carry the crate. It's heavy, so they share the load. And on the 13th day, the Kayadak return. They come fast, limbs clicking and clacking as they swarm from above and from below, pouring out like liquid shadow. They shriek and stab, and Juman tells Adar to go, go, keep going. Juman takes out his staff, spins it, and begins whipping it about. It connects with one Kayadak, then another, and the bug fiends are flung against the wall, screeching in pain. But there are too many. They swarm Juman. Adar hugs the heavy crate to his chest and runs. His calves burn. His knees feel like they're going to pop. Everything hurts, but he continues on. A locator at his wrist beeps.
This is it. This is where the crystals belong.
Smooth boreholes litter the walls. Here, the crystal isn't faceted, but rather sculpted, like wind-shaped glass. It's just like in Bryn's drawings. He rushes forward, nearly tripping on a berm of argonite poking up through the quartzine mantle. But he manages to stay on his feet as he ducks into the darkness of this new passageway. Deeper, deeper he runs, grunting in pain, holding back tears, ducking spears of crystal, slipping on smooth ground.
I've lost them.
I've lost the Kayadak. And I've lost Juman, too.
Soon the cave begins to glow. In the dark crystal walls are other, smaller gems, each glowing bright. Different colors, like eyes watching. Red, green, blue. A feeling overtakes him. A strange, giddy madness. It rises within him, effervescent like bubbles. And he wonders, is this what being drunk feels like?
Then the tack, tack, tack of Kayadak limbs.
They're coming!
Panic rushes through him. He turns and sees that the way he came in is the only way. There are no other points of entry.
Out there, the shadows move and shift, sweeping in with alarming swiftness.
And he pulls his blaster and grits his teeth and begins firing wildly into the space.
Plasma bolts cook the darkness.
Kayadak scream!
And crystals chatter. The walls and ceiling begin to fracture. The air is filled suddenly with the roar of the crumbling roof, and Adar falls,
crab walking backward as the cave passageway is swiftly closed off by a wall of ruined, broken crystal. He can barely catch his breath. The Kayadak are gone. The wall is impenetrable. Many of the creatures may be buried beneath it. Adar doesn't know. When he has his bearings, he sees now that there is nowhere deeper to go. This is the end of this cave.
He tries fruitlessly to dig himself out, but it is no use. The crystals cut his hands. The wall will not be moved. Instead, he slumps back against the wall and draws the crate toward him. He pops a series of latches. The lid opens. Inside waits a series of crystals, like the ones in the walls and ceiling above. Hundreds of them. Adar stifles a cry, then withdraws another of the projector discs.
He places it in his lap and ignites it. Again, the hollow form of Bryn Iziska appears. The vid of Bryn says,
just as the Jedi are a lens that focuses the Force, so is the Kyber crystal a lens that focuses the light inside the Jedi.
And the light inside the Jedi's weapon, the lightsaber.
But those crystals can be used for greater, more evil powers. The Sith focus the Force too. But they use it not for light, but only for destruction. These crystals were taken from Christophsis to power two of the most insidious weapons built. The legacy of Galen Erso. The legacy of Orson Krennic. Of Tarkin and the Sith. Of Palpatine and Vader. The Death Stars are gone. Light has persevered through the necessity of dark. These crystals must go home. That is your task.
With that, Adar begins taking the crystals out one by one, setting them down into the cave from which they had been taken years before. He sets the disc to project the hollow form once again. He tries not to think about how this is the place where he's going to die, or, in Bryn's words, where he will soon join with the living Force. All hail the light, the dark, and the gray.
Chapter 17.
At the camp, the troopers are dead. Efni has been reduced to spare parts. Bones frees the prisoners. Gom gapples as he's let loose, scrambling on all fours around the sand. The skull-eyed thing warbles with laughter, kneeling and raising its arms to the sky to take in its freedom. The others filter out together around the Imperial water supply and drink till their bellies must hurt. Nora tells them they'd do best to hightail it out of there,
because the Empire will soon come. And next time, they might put them in graves, not cages. She finds a speeder bike. She and Bones steal it and go. Together they travel for hours. Endless sand streaks past in mounding dunes that grow higher and higher. And soon the bike is cresting each hill and leaving her stomach behind with the drop back down on the far side. Bounce and dip, rise and fall. Worse, she has to close her eyes most of the time. She has no goggles, and the streaming sand burns her eyes. And it's not like she even knows where she's going. Right now, the priority is get away in any direction. The direction she picks is the one they chose at the outset. In the distance, she sees canyons and plateaus. The same ones, she believes, that they saw when they crash-landed here. So that's where she points the front prongs of the speeder. The blue sky begins to dim, bleeding at the horizon line. In the distance, she sees a pair of goggle-eyed humanoids half her size, digging in the sand. They don't even look up as the bike zips past. She hears something. An engine. A ship. That can't be good. The Empire controls the airspace here. Ahead, a small shape in the air grows larger and larger until she can see that it's a shuttle. Imperial, probably. Nora turns the speeder next to a heaping dune and lurks in its shadow as the ship passes overhead. It's not Imperial. It's some other make. Corellian, she thinks. It burns sky and keeps going until it's gone. Nora tells Bones to hold on again, then she throttles the speeder. It leaps forward like a haunch-whipped Viractyl. And again, they're up and racing across the sands. Fat plumes of dust filling the air behind them. Soon, though, she hears that ship once more. And she hears it too late to hide. The shuttle blasts past. It's not the Empire, so they should be safe, right? Except now the vessel is slowing down. It eases to a stop, hovering above the next dune. Slowly, its blunt front end starts to rotate back toward her direction. Oh, no. Whoever it is, this can't be good. They have to keep on moving. Go around, she thinks. She turns the speeder so it'll take a far path around the shuttle, just in case. But as she whips past, someone is yelling. At her? To her? Wait, they're yelling her name. Nora! She tilts her heels back and pops the brakes. The bike skids to a halt in a spray of sand. She was right. The pilot of that ship is a bounty hunter. There, on the far dune next to the shuttle, stands Jazz Amari. Jazz takes the shuttle up toward the Red Rock Canyons, and there, as night falls, they park the ship in the shadows of a rocky overhang. Without even caring whose ship this is or where Jazz got it, Nora greedily feasts on food from a locker. It's not good food. It's a survivalist ration of Kukula nuts, dried Galcott, and Kalpa sea threads. But just the same, it may be the best thing she's ever eaten. And they have a water recycler, too. That she gulps down. It's cold and hurts her throat, and it's amazing. Everything is amazing. She wants to sleep. She wants to dance the way Bones is dancing right now. Dance, then sleep. Sleep, then dance. I'm alive. I'm with Jazz. I'm fed. Jazz stands in the doorway as Nora fills her cheeks with food. The bounty hunter has her arm against one side of the frame, her hip cocked and pressed against the other.
You look hungry.
They barely fed us.
Me neither. Trust me, I had my gorge on everything moment too. Sorry I didn't come sooner. I was in a similar predicament.
How? What happened?
Jazz tells her. About Nima the Hutt, about Mercurial Swift, about stealing this ship.
Your head,
Nora says, suddenly seeing the crust of blood and the missing horns.
You need Bacta.
I need nothing. I'll be fine.
Jazz, always stoic.
My horns are broken, but they'll grow back over time. Don't worry about it. What we need to worry about is our next move. We have a ship, and I checked the computer. It has Imperial clearance codes. They work for now, though if Swift reports it to the Empire, that may not last forever. But with clearance codes in hand, Nora, we could leave Jakku. Right now.
Reflexive fear rises inside Nora's heart at just the thought of once more flying through the Imperial fleet massing here, like the Death Star run all over again. But no, this would be safe. They have the proper codes. And yet, to what end? Their mission is a failure.
I suppose we should do that. Get back to Chandrila. Tell them what we've seen here.
She sighs.
Though that means none of this was worth it. We found nothing. Sloane gets away, and we've made no difference.
Jazz arches an eyebrow.
Well, there is one thing.
What?
I found Sloane.
Those three words. Colder and more refreshing than any water. Nora can barely breathe.
Tell me.
I didn't see much. It was as they were taking me in. The hut was getting ready for some kind of expedition. The whole place was like a nest of red jackets knocked out of a tree. Sloane was with them.
And do you know where they were going?
I heard a little. They were going to head past the canyons. There's some valley beyond it. That's where they're headed. Part of some caravan.
And Sloane? What was she doing there?
Jazz shrugs with her eyes.
No clue. She didn't look like she wanted to be there, but she wasn't a prisoner. And I almost didn't recognize her.
Why?
She wasn't in uniform. No Imperial gear or markings or anything. She looked like any other dust suck or a scavenger. She was talking to someone. A man. Another scavenger, I guess. And that's all I saw. They dragged me back into my cell.
Nora finishes chewing one last Kukula nut. She stares off at an unfixed point as she speaks.
We could go home. Or we could go after Sloane.
Unless you want to set up shop on Jakku as a couple of sand merchants. Yes, I figure those are our choices.
We should go home. That's the smart thing to do.
It is.
Though we don't always do the smart thing.
We rarely do, it seems.
Nora sighs.
What about you? What do you think?
Nora, I'm a bounty hunter. I'm like an Anuba with scent in its nose. I don't like to stop until the target is clamped tight in my jaws. But I'm not the boss here. You are. You brought us here, so I leave it to you.
I want Sloane.
Then let's go get Sloane.
Nora stands and thrusts out a hand. Jazz takes it and shakes it.
They embrace. It feels good.
Bones is there suddenly, thrusting his jagged-toothed droid skull in between their hug. Slowly, his metal arms enfold them, patting them both awkwardly on the back.
Hello. I am enjoying this hug, too. Hug, hug, hug. A hug is like violence made of love.
Jazz asks Nora,
and where did you find him exactly?
I didn't find him. He found me.
Part 3. Chapter 18.
John Burrell is drowning. He cannot get air, and he struggles against the sea as it drags him down.
His lungs burn.
Something coils around his foot.
Sea vines? Or an eel? Oh, he can't get traction. His hands flap like the broken wings of a dying bird. A bird who can't lift off, who can't escape what's coming. The salt water fills his nostrils and his one empty eye socket, and the other eye bulges like a cork in a bottle about to pop. Wake up! He gasps and sits up. His clothes, his sheets, everything pickled in sour sweat. But still he can't breathe, and he grabs at his face and finds something there. A wet cloth. He flings it away like it's vermin. Someone is standing by the bed. Jom grunts and throws a punch, but the trespasser handily sidesteps it. He glares through one bleary, sleep-pebbled eye at his intruder. Jom knows the cut of that jib. A shadow long and lean, skin the color of Sakai wood, everything sharp as a pair of snip shears.
Sinjir,
Jom snarls.
How nice of you to pay me a visit. And...
he picks up the washcloth. Water drips from its corners.
And drape a wet wash rag over my face as I slept.
A small torment and an attempt to wake you up, the ex-imperial says.
You could have tried. Oh, hey, wake up, Jom. Or how about a nudge? Maybe a little tickle?
His voice sounds like gravel grinding in his lungs.
I don't go right to simulated drowning, you old gilgoat. Don't you military type sleep light? I tried the sweet talking and the gentle shake, 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 but as it turns out, you sleep like you're temporarily dead. I yelled, nothing. I kicked your bed, and nothing. That's when I turned to torture, when everything else I tried failed. Sinjir hmms. The story of my life, really.
Jom drapes his legs over the bed. He feels around nearby for his eye patch, which he pops on over his head and missing eye. They offered to do something better for him. A fake one, or even better, some kind of ocular implant. But he told them to shove it. A proper old eye patch it would be.
What do you want, Rathvelis?
God, you stink. You were drinking, you naughty lad.
And I'll be drinking again as soon as you leave me alone.
Things have been tough for Jom. A small voice reminds him.
You made them tougher, though, didn't you?
After Kashyyyk, he felt lost.
Publicly, they gave him a medal, but privately, he'd abandoned life as a commando. They chastised him for abandoning his role and breaking rank. He didn't know if they'd take him back. He never asked. He just didn't have it in him. Didn't have anything in him, it seemed. Like he was a cup tipped over. His contents spilled out. It had, and has, nothing to do with jazz, he reminds himself daily, nightly, hourly, every waking momently. It's definitely not that he loves her and misses her and feels lost without her. Because no, hell no, that would make him a fool. A starry-eyed, gas-brained fool.
Fine. Maybe it's that he misses her. But he also misses work. Proper work. He's out of spec forces. That thanks to Kashyyyk. He went astray there, committing himself to an unsanctioned, meaning illegal, military action. Of course, it was a military action that went well, and brought success to the New Republic at a time it needed it, which means his discharge was an honorable one. But he's still out. So he drifts. He takes jobs where he can. Recently, he washed up on the shores of the Senate, working as a bodyguard in the pool of freelancers the Republic is using to provide extra protection for its politicians. Their first vote after Liberation Day was to give themselves extra security, which was probably smart, but to Jom reeks of overindulgent self-protection. He's assigned to whatever senator requests protection. It's dull work. He'd rather be back with his fellow commandos, dropping down out of orbit into Atmo,
locked and loaded, with his mates at his back. Those days, he fears, are done.